So what I think is that we're all creative. We just use it differently. Writing novels, making beats, cooking dinner, raising kids. So if creativity is a power, an ability that we all have, then the issue is, how do you choose to use it? And what impact is that going to have on your life? The philosopher Jim Holt is interested in extreme creativity, what we call genius. He's got a new collection of essays called When Einstein Walked with Gödel. It's about beautiful minds in science and math. He told Steve that being a truly original thinker is rarely easy or even comfortable.
I think that whenever it's a matter of truly transcendent human achievement, there's going to be a lot of suffering. There's going to be a lot of struggle. Struggle and suffering that the fragile human psyche often can't take it. This is not peculiar, certainly, to science and mathematics. It's also found in music and art. You know, Beethoven had a pretty turbulent life. It's hard to find a great visual artist who was a nice guy. Yeah, it sort of goes with the territory of being a genius and being a great original figure. It's also true in philosophy. I mean, figures like Ludwig Wittgenstein and Nietzsche had very, very turbulent lives. I would maintain that these lives are objectively better than the happy lives that ordinary people like us aspire to because they're making contact with something that's objectively valuable.
Even though they might be kind of miserable in the process.
Of the many figures that I write about in this book, there are two or perhaps three suicides, one of whom is, of course, David Foster Wallace, who, like me, gravitated to these beautiful ideas, particularly the idea of infinity.
Right. And we should just point out that, I mean, a lot of people who were even David Foster Wallace fans may not realize that he actually was very knowledgeable about mathematics and wrote a whole book on infinity.
Yes, yes, yes. It's like reading a beautiful Mallarmé poem to me. But tragic figure David Foster Wallace, and also Alan Turing, who, of course, in solving the greatest problem in logic over the centuries, managed to invent the computer as a sort of byproduct of that. And to cap it off, he cracked the Enigma code of the Nazis in the Second World War, thereby saving countless lives, shortening the war by a couple of years probably. And he, too, committed suicide under very mysterious circumstances.
Let's just talk about that for a moment.
Okay.
So he'd done all these amazing things. As you say, he was also gay. It was illegal to engage in homosexual acts in England at the time. This was shortly after the Second World War. And he was actually criminally prosecuted for that.
And at the time, it was not known. His heroic role in the Second World War was still top secret. So nobody knew that he was instrumental in saving Britain during the dark days of the early part of the war. So he was prosecuted, and he was given a choice between a brief prison sentence or chemical castration, submitting to injections of female hormones. He chose the latter. It had a terrible effect on his body. He was a long-distance runner, and it caused his breasts to grow and that sort of thing. And a few years after that, he was found dead by his housekeeper, and there was a cyanide-laced apple by the side of his bed. When I think about the way Turing was treated, it brings tears to my eyes.
Yeah. And there were others who it wasn't so much that society cracked down on them, but they just fell apart themselves. Tell me about some of these other people.
Well, one of these figures is in the title of my book, Kurt Gödel, the greatest logician since Aristotle, perhaps a greater logician than Aristotle. He's famous for having proved Gödel's incompleteness theorem, which was a very shocking and profound result that said essentially that mathematics transcends logic, that no logical system can capture all of the truths of mathematics. This hit the mathematical community like a thunderbolt. So Gödel was an Austrian. He came to America in the 1930s when the Nazis took over Austria in the Anschluss. And he came to the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, where Einstein was already the most famous fixture. And everyone was quite intimidated by Einstein at the time, but not Gödel. Gödel and Einstein immediately became very close friends. And every day they would walk to the Institute from their homes in Princeton and back and talk about all kinds of profound and beautiful things, particularly the nature of time.
And we should point out that Einstein didn't do this with other people. He was actually a total snob. But Gödel, he considered kind of an intellectual equal, right?
And Gödel was his intellectual equal. When I talk to mathematicians, my friends who were in higher mathematics at Harvard and Berkeley and so forth, they maintain that Gödel was one of the 10 greatest mathematicians of all time. You know, we think of him as a logician, but what he did in logic was essentially show how the theory of numbers, the theory of arithmetic, could be made to talk about itself, saying, I am not provable. And so he was very friendly with and very close to Einstein and practically no one else, Kurt Gödel. Lived in a little house in Princeton with his wife, and they put a pink flamingo out on the lawn, which Gödel was very, very fond of. He and Turing, actually, were slightly obsessed with the Disney movie Snow White.
Really?
Which is an odd thing about him. Gödel also believed in ghosts. He had a morbid fear of refrigerator gases, but he was quite paranoid. He was awarded the National Medal of Science in 1974 when Gerald Ford was president, and he refused to go to Washington to accept it from Ford because he thought that someone might be trying to assassinate him. And he began to think that there was a plot to poison him and that everyone was participating in this plot. And so his reaction to that paranoiac fear was to stop eating food, right? So you think there's a plot to kill you, and you stop eating food, and so you kill yourself.
So he started starving himself then.
This great logician kind of died of a paradox. We're laughing about it now. Comedy equals tragedy plus time. But it was really, really sad. He was, you know, he weighed something like 70 pounds when he finally was taken to the hospital in Princeton. The diagnosis was self-starvation. He died in 1976. And then there are other cases. I mean, my favorite, a very special figure to me, because it was through this figure that when I was young and in college, I was introduced to the idea of abstract intellectual beauty, was Évariste Galois, G-A-L-O-I-S, mm-hmm. who was a French boy, I should say, because he died before he reached his 21st birthday in 1832 in a duel. He died in a duel with a man who was probably a government provocateur of the Orléanist royalty in France, because Galois was a bit of a political firebrand and subversive figure as a student. And on the eve of the duel, Évariste Galois wrote a letter to a friend in which he laid out all of the essential points of what we now call group theory. And the idea that this absolutely foundational, deep, profound, beautiful discovery was due to a teenager, essentially, yeah. who died in a duel.
So
by the way, if there's a movie ever made about Galois, he should have been played by the young Leo DiCaprio. That's what he looked like. I'm trying to make him seem even more romantic.
So let me just get this straight. So he's, what, 21 years old? He knows he's about 20 years old.
No, I didn't make it to 21.
He's about to go fight a duel. And just in case he dies, he decides, oh, yeah, I better tell people about this amazing theory, this discovery that I've made, and just sort of leave it for posterity there, and that's what we know of him.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, he was trying – there was a longstanding mathematical problem that mathematicians had been grappling with for centuries. It really goes back to the Greeks. The young Galois was trying to solve a higher version of that that had stumped mathematicians for centuries. And as one of my friends put it, he didn't solve this problem. He hacked it. He came up with this beautiful theory that showed that the problem was – insoluble.
Yeah. I just sort of want to try to make sense of some of these stories that you've just outlined. On the one hand, there's something, you know, we could put a romantic gloss on some of these stories, you know, the connection between genius and madness, or maybe these are stories of intellectual mavericks, renegades, whose minds just simply ran away from them. They sort of didn't know when to stop. They needed a reality check, but couldn't because no one else was there to do that for them.
Yeah, and they're communing with a transcendent reality in a way. A good example of this is the figure Georg Cantor, who was the discoverer of the theory of infinity in the late 19th century. And Cantor was a figure who was of a very strong mystical tendency. He was very interested in the Kabbalah, the Jewish mystical tradition. He was tended to be morbidly depressive. He actually died in a mental asylum. But he single-handedly created the theory of infinity that underlies modern mathematics. And this is a figure that I mentioned earlier also made a very powerful impression on David Foster Wallace. And David Foster Wallace wrote an entire book about Cantor and the theory of infinity. But Cantor, he proved that not only is there a single infinity, there is actually an infinite hierarchy of infinities, of greater and greater infinities. In his mind, they culminated in the idea of the absolute. And he believed this vision of an infinite hierarchy of infinities had been vouchsafed to him by God. It's quite interesting the way mathematics, which you think of as the ultimate rational pursuit, is so akin to mysticism.
Right. Jim, I can't think of anyone else who quite does what you do. You are a philosopher who writes a lot about some very heady subjects in science and mathematics, and as far as I can tell, you do not have an academic position, which is pretty unusual for an American philosopher. So I'm curious, how would you describe what you do?
I used to say I was a journalist, and now people keep calling me a philosopher, and I'm not so self-effacing that I won't accept the label. Many of my friends are philosophers here in New York at Columbia and NYU, particularly philosophers of physics and cosmology. And I like the idea of bringing esoteric ideas in contemporary philosophy to a larger public. So I see that as my service. I have very few original ideas, perhaps no original ideas. That's not so bad. Einstein only had two original ideas, so I'm only two behind Einstein. But I tend to gravitate to other people who have original ideas and are sometimes not as lyrical in explaining them as they might be. And so that's my humble function in this culture.
And that's Jim Holt, talking with Steve Paulson about his book, When Einstein Walked with Gödel, Excursions to the Edge of Thought.